Well, good afternoon. Welcome back after lunch. My name is Tony Byrne. I'm really excited to see all of these faces. When this conference was first announced about 8 months ago, I don't know why I had this vision that there were going to be like 20 of us in some dank basement somewhere all wearing tweed and, you know, talking very abstract concepts. And it's exciting, all the energy around this particular conference. One of my contentions, however, is that despite all of the energy that is going into open source content management systems, in the last 2 years, I believe that the commercial providers have actually advanced farther and more broadly. And it's a rather puzzling conclusion that I've come to, and it'd be interesting to hear a bit more from you. But even if you disagree with that contention, hopefully this session will be useful for you, either as a buyer or as someone who manages an open source project as far as a roadmap. These are some features that I believe people find very attractive and you might want to consider for your own efforts. So just a little bit of background. CMS Watch is a site I started a couple of years ago, and just for the record, it runs on Midgard, an open source content management system. And what I do for a living is help organizations. Typically, I help facilitate a product selection process. So a lot of the things that I highlight today are things that my clients, when they saw them, they said, I like this. This is what I want. This is what I need. And feel free to contact me at any time. I still need to convert this presentation to slide slide ML. I will do that, and it will be completely available in that capacity. So I'm going to talk about 10 features this afternoon, and you'll see that I'm kind of weighing them here in three different categories, putting especially major emphasis on editorial and management tools, because after all, this is what content management systems are designed to do, is help managers and content owners do their thing. And this is particularly an area in the last couple of years where I believe many commercial players have been very successful in figuring out how to get those constituents excited and on board about their particular offerings. But then, of course, there's also certain technical features or attributes that are also important. And at the end of each section, just because we're at a university, I'll throw in some other things that we'll just call extra credit. And we can talk about those more offline if you want. So just as a little bit of background, I think it's come out several times already that when you say content management system, many people have a variety of different definitions for that. And to my mind, a content management system is really not about the actual product or the actual package. Granted, you do need underlying technologies, but there are commercial vendors and open source projects who say, well, come use our content management system. And that's not really what they're providing. They're providing content management technology. The system is what you make out of it. And so this is a rather crude sort of just input-output diagram. But it gets to the heart of what I think the core issue is, which is what a content management system allows you to do is take content, ideally content in different formats and from different locations, and apply some business rules and some approval processes to that content, and thereby add more value to that content, and also reduce the cost of being able to publish that content over the web or other electronic channels, okay, so that you can publish more, publish better, publish faster. And that's really what the system is all about. And sometimes we have a tendency, I think, when we get really deep into the technology and the architectures, to forget about that. So some of the screens I'm going to be showing are really oriented more towards what are some of the key business drivers that people are trying to achieve. A few caveats. First of all, the features that I'm showing you, it's not like every commercial product has them, but I think that these are becoming sort of canonical features, and in the next couple of versions of most commercial products, you'll see these things. Some of these features, I'm sure, can be found in some open source projects, probably say something, and someone will wave their hand and say, well, ours does that too. And that's fine. I don't profess to know them all. But in general, the things that I'm going to show are things that typically you don't always see or you rarely see in open source content management systems. You could, of course, take a big, broad, open source platform and build some of this stuff yourself as a user. The question I have is that if this is fairly basic stuff, you know, features that other people need, why should you have to build it? It should really be part of the, at least available natively out of the tarball. The survey, like I said, is not at all scientific. It's based on my own anecdotal experience, and I should say that that's working mostly with EDUs and .com and some .gov entirely in North America. So to the extent that there may be some regional spin on this, the environment in Europe is and certainly Asia is bound to be a bit different. Okay, so first let's talk about editorial tools, and there's going to be five things here. The first one is has to do with getting is this seemingly now age-old problem of getting content out of Word and into something more you know, less proprietary, non-binary, all that good stuff. And there are a number of ways of doing this. Many products rely on Microsoft's own HTML converter, which, as you know, is just awful. And so, therefore, what you have is a lot of other people writing post-processors and plugging those in and trying to clean it all up. And it's extremely frustrating and difficult. And you know, a number of commercial products in particular have tried to find ways of going right from Word to XML, putting plugins into Word that will try to divine the semantic values of the different elements within a Word document and so forth. And most people don't use those. They look very good in demos. The way most content, in my experience, gets from Word into content management systems is by copying and pasting. And in a way, that's not always a bad thing because you're relying on the intelligence of the actual author that there may be certain things that they want to add and maybe certain things that they don't. And what some content management systems are doing that I really like and my clients really like is making this a more intelligent process. They recognize, okay, I'm copying and pasting some Word in. Now I'm going to give you some different options about what to do with that Word content. And here, I can paste it the top, I don't know how well you can see that, but the top radio button is pasted in using Word formatting. Okay, so you're going to get these ugly Microsoft tags, but maybe that's okay for you. Or you may replace non-standard fonts. You may want to paste it as just plain. And so it gives the actual author, now granted the author needs a little bit of training to use this system, but it puts them in control of how that Word text ends up in the content management system. The second one is particularly important on corporate sites where, unlike a news site where you're constantly aggregating a lot of new content, a lot of corporate sites, and I say that broadly, which could include a lot of nonprofits, you're going back and re-editing a lot of the same stuff over and over again. And at that point, versioning starts becoming extremely critical. And one of the things that a number of commercial packages have done is put together some very intuitive versioning systems where they give you visual diffs of the actual content, and this is sort of like if you turn on versioning within a Microsoft Office application. In fact, some of these use DHTML, so you can actually roll over it and find out who made what change when. And this can be used within a workflow before you've officially versioned something, or to go back and review the diff between two different versions before you decide whether you're going to roll back or not. And editors, particularly in large distributed organizations, I find really like this a lot and use it a lot to help them keep track of what they're doing and what their team is doing. Visual workflow cues, this one should be just a slam dunk, and there's no reason why anyone shouldn't do this. And what this is a product called Marant, and what it does is this is the typical inbox, okay? Almost every content management system has an inbox where you log in and says, here's the tasks waiting for you that may be lined up in your workflow queue. And what it does is, for each unique workflow or content type, it gives you a visual cue of where that particular object that you're supposed to work on, where is it in a broader workflow? So you have a context here. This guy's saying, okay, this particular thing that I need to work on is in now in the review stage, and then it's going to go through another approval process, and then it's going to be published. Otherwise, particularly if you have multiple workflows for different content objects, I have to work on something, but I don't know where I don't remember where I am in the cycle. I've got to remember what was this workflow supposed to do for me, or for the organization, and where am I in this whole process? And this gives you a visual cue. They do this all in DHTML. Just a visual cue for each item that I'm working on. Where does it fit in the broader sort of workflow pipeline? The next one is extremely controversial. This is a screenshot from a product called Day. It's browser-based image editing. Some other companies are beginning to do this now, too. And some people love this, some people hate it. Designers tend to hate it because they fear that if you give people the rights to work on in a browser on a native Photoshop file and scale it and crop it or put text over it, or put a caption underneath that and have that caption become part of the image as opposed to a separate element, that you might disturb the artistic integrity of the file. But a lot of marketing people love this, because if you think about it, it's really weird that we've had content management systems to create systems for managing text and to distribute that management capability out within the organization. But images, no, that's not something you deal with in content management. That's all off in this offline black box, goes through a separate approval process unless you have invested in a digital asset management system, which can be quite expensive and overkill just for web publishing. So what a number of companies have done is taken just the web-oriented pieces of traditional digital asset management technologies and embedded them into their system. Whether you want to take advantage of this or not is a separate issue. A lot of it depends on the sort of images you're publishing. No, you can jump right in if it has to do with this.
Do they have any method of enforcing file size?
The end user author has no concept of, file size.
There's an API where you can do that, and of course you also set rights so that not everyone has the rights to go in and just edit this. That's part of the whole rights management system. I don't think that's native in this particular implementation. That would be something that you would have to, that would probably have to be custom constrained via the API.
But is it a common problem, or?
What they're more interested in is not the necessarily the weight of the, but it's the image size. Is that what you're referring to? Yes. Yeah, that's a very common thing, is to fit it in.
So I was just going to say, we use a product which uses Image Magic internally, and we'll scale images and all that kind of stuff to
on the server.
Standard size on the server, yeah.
Do it through a browser.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Image Magic? Okay. The next feature is a pre-localized interface. And this is a screen from, I believe, Red Dot, and they ship out of the box with the administrative and contributor interfaces in multiple different languages. A number of other major and minor CMSs do as well. So that's different from having a localizable interface, which means, you could go localize it yourself. But this actually, the work has been done, probably in conjunction with some of their customers and partners, and this is the authoritative, and they've made a commitment that when they make changes in the source language, that they'll make changes to the interface and the new versions and all of these derivative languages as well. The key here, again, though, is what access do you have to the administrative interfaces in the first place, because you may not like the way that they've localized it, or you may want to do some sort of extension off that. You may, for example, want to take this French and make it a bit more Québécois or something like that. Okay. So a few extra credit. One that we talked about already a little bit in some other sessions is in-context editing, which means you can browse to a page, log in, click on an icon and edit this page button. And that's pretty nifty. Most content management systems have this feature now. But it can be a little bit problematic, though, because if you think about this notion of having a single source of an object that then is propagated out to multiple pages, you have pretty serious dependency problems. And many of the first generation in-context editing people started hitting up against this, which is, for example, I might go to a page and I've got the rights to edit the left nav on that page because I want to edit it. But that left nav also appears, that object, that content object, appears on a bunch of other pages, essentially even on other sites. Okay, so how do I know what the impact of the change is through the workflow process? And so what this begs is some kind of dependency analysis and reporting such that changes that are made to a particular instance of an object, I understand how those changes are going to cascade across all my different web properties. And that's a little bit tricky. I don't think that there's a lot of usability issues with that, but a number of commercial vendors in their recent versions have come up with some fairly interesting approaches to dealing with that problem. Auto-classification is being able to take a document and have a machine at least begin to infer what the metadata might be about that document based on your taxonomy. It's a very tricky issue. There's a lot of different approaches to it, but most of the major commercial products now have some sort of basic auto-classification engine to help organizations, not as a substitute for human metadata entry, but as something that just kind of helps speed up the process. Widgets for plumbing relational databases. Many people want to just publish plain old catalog-type relational content that doesn't necessarily need to be or want to be in the content management system, and it sure would be nice if my content management system had the capability for a business user to be able to drop in queries into that as an element on a page without having to go back to a DBA or a developer to be able to write the script to be able to do that. So those are just a few extra features that are useful. Okay, management tools. This is a screen from Crown Peak, we call these content management systems. And if you're managing something, you want to know what's going on. You want some reports and to be able to measure things that are happening, partly to hold people accountable, but perhaps more importantly, to just be able to figure out where are our bottlenecks, what's going on. Why hasn't Sue logged in? We trained her 2 weeks ago. She hasn't logged in yet. What's going on? Maybe I need a better sort of change management regime. That was one of the reports here. I love this one. Never logged in. Okay, I mean it's a realistic thing. You can go out to major corporations, train 100 people in the content management system, and maybe the first 6 months, 40 of them never log in. And how good do you think that training was after 6 months if they haven't used the system once? So these are the sorts of things. And I hate this excuse that a number of commercial vendors also do is say, well, it's all logged, the data's all there, just run your favorite report writer against it. Well, that's not really the point. What you want is for it to be integrated in the content management system so you can use the same permissioning structures and everything, because you may not want everyone to see the same reports, and I don't want to have to pull out a separate report writer to do these things. Among other things, I may want to act right there on the data that I see. This one I think also is huge, which is configurable forms-based workflow modeling, I should say. Not configurable forms-based workflow as an actor, but actually being a business user, actually being able to go and create a new workflow, including a very complex workflow. My wish for all of you is to have very simple workflows, but in the real world, sometimes content has to go through multiple steps, maybe go in parallel paths. You may want to trigger all kinds of different events like escalations or de-escalations or rerouting. There's a number. Workflow is not a new science. It's been around since document management. A lot of the terms and approaches are very well known. It's a question of building an interface such that business people can define what their business process is going to be. And a number of commercial vendors, after really kind of tripping and falling on building browser-based GUIs to do this, have settled on forms-based interfaces where it takes 10 minutes to show a business manager how to create a new workflow, including who gets what email when, what behaviors happen after a certain amount of time, and all of that stuff. This, I don't remember if this was from Red Dot or Crown Peak, but one of those two. By the way, another new trend is to provide plugins into Visio that then output WFML, which is a workflow markup language, compliant XML that can then be ingested into the content management system so that I can do all my workflows in Visio, and then actually you typically right-click on a particular, like a box or a circle or whatever, and it communicates with the content management system and tells you what different configurations you can set there. And then once you develop everything in Visio, get it validated by the business user, it connects to the content management system and uses WFML to drop in the XML, and voila, you have a new workflow. One thing, though, you never would want to do in that situation is then edit that XML in a text editor and then try to round-trip that back to Visio, which I would not recommend doing. But anyway, this is, I think, the last one here, which is 508 or web-accessible compliant output. This is a big issue, as you probably know, with any kind of WYSIWYG editing, particularly WYSIWYG editing within a browser where you're using like an ActiveX control or a Java applet. They may generate well-formed XHTML, but they're probably not going to generate 508 compliant HTML. Now, you can enforce the basic stuff, like all your images must have alt tags, but the one tricky one that people generally don't seem to deal with is this whole notion that you have to have table headings and column, row headings as well to be 508 compliant. And you can't really necessarily do that in a post-processor. Okay? A human being needs to do that. So here's a screen from Merint where they've got a DHTML widget for their rich editing within the browser. And then they have these couple clicks here where if you need to be 508 compliant, this is a table wizard, table creation wizard, pretty standard stuff. You see these in all the WYSIWYG sort of widgets. They've got a little click here. It says, with the accessibility tag, that says build first row using header cell tags and build first column using header cell tags. Okay, this is basic sort of stuff that you need for 508 compliance. Because the question is, why do you even have to ask? Why isn't that the default? And that's because they're not presuming that all of their clients always want to be 508 compliant. Because there are some companies that don't want to go to the extra effort of putting in this non-visible text. Okay? Not everyone wants to take the extra effort that's 508 compliant.
I'm just not understanding what the effort was if all it means is you had to check a box.
Oh, well, what that means then is to complete the table, you've got to actually put in the text.
Okay.
Right. So if I don't want to be bothered putting in the text, I don't check the box because I don't care if this page is technically 508 compliant is really what I'm saying there. Okay. Two extra credit. One is taxonomy management tools. People, the information architecture community is beginning to do a great job about educating the rest of us on the importance of taxonomies, controlled vocabularies. People are beginning to get a sense that they need to manage these dynamically, and forms-based interfaces to do that in a content management system is tremendously useful because taxonomies are living things. Distributed user management, this one is huge, 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 and in fact some major commercial vendors that still don't do this today, and it's a serious issue for them in multi-site, highly distributed corporate environments, or even, say, university environment. And what that is, which is to create a new user and assign rights to that user, do I have to go to a sysadmin or some central super user somewhere, typically within the IT group, or can I distribute in a hierarchical fashion user rights to other kind of a departmental sysadmin or website sysadmin who is a business manager who can add, delete, and create entitlements for other users, okay, and essentially completely oversee how those users work in the system. And people want that. Particularly if it's multiple sites all under one content management framework. They don't want to be calling the and going into a trouble ticket queue for an IT group to put a new user in their content management system. This one isn't necessarily a feature, but a phenomenon. And Dave Weiner talked this morning about what he thought was the demise of the 40-person software firm. I think that firm is alive and well in this space. Some of them are doing very well. ASPs in particular are doing quite well for some specialized reasons we can get into. But the fact is that you can buy perfectly good, whether it meets your requirements or not is another issue, but perfectly good content management software relatively cheaply today. Ektron, which is a fine starter package, is $3,000. Paperthin, for which I've shown a couple of slides, is only $20,000. Now, it runs on ColdFusion. If you're like me, you hate ColdFusion, but Paperthin is a good, it's a good product for particular circumstances. It's got a lot of web-based forms for building and managing sites that they don't actually, you don't even have to use very much of a ColdFusion developer. And the point is here is many of these products have become quite sophisticated and indeed quite extensible such that I've been in selection, helping organizations with selections, and these products actually beat out open source products on price. Now, it may be that you may be willing to pay more for an open source because you want that source, okay? But the amount of effort that it was going to take that open source product and get it to do what these inexpensive products did actually pushed them out from a price perspective. Okay, technical tools. This is kind of the fun stuff, so I could go on and on here, but we'll just take a few, just a couple of cuts at it. First is the need to be able to integrate with other information systems in an organization. Those information systems could be file systems, databases, portals, ERP systems, HR systems, you name it. A lot of that stuff needs to hit the web, whether intranet, extranet, or public site, and generally speaking, the products that are very good at this are the traditional enterprise players, such as Vignette and Documentum and so forth. And people ask me, why on earth would someone pay $250,000 out of the gate for Vignette? And the answer really is this, is that they have what were not always but are now relatively mature connectors and connector SDKs to be able to put other information systems under some kind of a management regime. This is the Vignette SDK, which actually, and I have mixed feelings about these sorts of, this is basically a Vignette-specific Java IDE, okay? It generates a set of Java classes and some JSP is what comes out of this. But what it allows you to do, and it's a developer tool, it's not a business user tool, but what it allows you to do is visually use their preset connectors that they have for SAP and PeopleSoft and others, and then also extend those and build off of that such that you can create web pages with content drawn either in advance or at runtime from other systems. Okay, and that's pretty, it's not a simple thing to do. And 2 years ago, Vignette and others were trying to do this, and I don't think doing it very well. But a lot of the tools for this have matured over time, and in particular, some of the standards such as JCA and JMS have also matured. One of the other interesting things that you can do with this, you wouldn't need to necessarily use this framework, is that they also use it as a migration tool. This is actually using their HTML connector, and what you're doing is visually looking at an existing HTML page and then working out a logical migration to a different a new structure with some of the same content. And now I know that many, including commercial vendors, already have Perl scripts and other kind of migration utilities and widgets. And one interesting thing would be to maybe for the different community to work together on a single open source migration tool that can be used both by developers and business managers as well, because migration can be extremely expensive, sometimes the most expensive. Yes?
Wait, how does it handle the priority
Right. So that's the issue. How does it handle? It does. It either allows you to build in a rule, in which case you've got to go down to the script about what to do when you encounter something unexpected, or it does what many scripts are designed to do for this. It throws an error and puts that into a pile that says, I need a human to go look at this. And so at the end of the day, migration is a whole separate issue. A lot of it depends on the cleanliness of your existing HTML. And there's no way you can automate around that, really. Browser-based content object development, this is pretty interesting, too. It's a little bit more of a sophisticated feature, but I think potentially very useful, which is I want to create a new content object. It's called a case study. And I know what elements I want in that case study, and I know the behavior of those elements and which ones are images and which ones are text and which ones are lookups. And I'm going to do that together to create a case study object. And what this does is gives business people a browser-based interface to do that. So you don't need a DBA or a developer. This one is from a product called Media Surface from the UK, and it gives you a wizard to do it, and then you can go in manually and edit the fields, the composite types, related types, and that sort of thing. This is a screen from Fatwire, which is a little bit of a friendlier way of doing kind of the same thing. Some other vendors have similar things but very often you have to already have the data model and have a database underneath, and then it will allow you to connect to a table and then auto-generate all the forms that you need to manage input and different output instances from that table. Under this, you don't actually, it's data model neutral. You can create whatever objects you want, and it modifies the underlying store accordingly. So some other things that are happening in the commercial world, albeit never as fast as one would like, but one of the things that I'm seeing more of is more open architectures, more adherence to J2E standards and being able to just work in any J2E container, to work with LDAP servers, to be RDBMS neutral. I mean, one of the things that drives me nuts about Red Hat CCM is you must use Oracle. I think that's crazy. If I have a content management system, I can accept the fact that I must use a relational database, but please let me use whichever relational database that I would like. Particularly, at least let me use one of the two major open source ones. The other thing that's been kind of a new development this year is a real-time LDAP or Active Directory integration. And the way, particularly LDAP, the way many products traditionally did it was you would do a nightly synchronization of the LDAP directory, the corporate LDAP directory, and whatever proprietary authentication system that the content management system was using. And what that means is that if somebody leaves the organization at 2 p.m., they quit, and they get removed from the LDAP directory, they still have edit rights to the content management system until midnight that night, unless somebody remembers to also turn them off in the content management system, which kind of defeats the whole purpose of having a centralized directory structure in the first place. So a number of organizations have dealt with that now by actually using the LDAP server as the runtime authentication mechanism and then building entitlements off that, application-specific entitlements off that within the content management system. This is a big bugaboo for me personally, and maybe it's a personal thing and I shouldn't be generalizing about it, but I believe that content management and content delivery are two very different things, and that you need to accomplish very different things in those phases. One is about the whole business process and approval process to getting content so that it's authoritative production type content. The other is about getting that content to a user. So things that happen at runtime are caching, personalization, maybe some syndication stuff, so on and so forth. And my theory is that no single product is ever going to be best of breed at both of these. Okay. So what I want is a really good content management system and a really good delivery system. And we already have, by the way, a great delivery system for static content. It's called Apache Web Server. So please don't make me use another web server just so that I can use your content management system. Okay. So here's a little manifesto that I wrote up, and it's I go into this in greater detail in an article on CMS Watch, but this is sort of some of the things that if you wanted to plunk down 2 kopecks, in Russia you can't give people unsolicited advice unless they pay you some number of kopecks. But anyway, I'll imagine that you plunk down some kopecks and have asked, you know, what should we as an open source community be doing? This would be it. First of all, fewer projects and more real product managers. 75 open source content management systems is an indication of the amount of energy, but it's not necessarily an indication of the overall health of the open source content management community, in my opinion. The vast majority of those are very small operations that, while they may not go away, they're not going to necessarily thrive. And my wish would be for the community to coalesce around certain winning products or projects. And I know that's a huge sociological issue, and I'm not a sociologist, but this would be one of my wishes. Move up the stack, which is don't, within the content management system, try to make a new repository. Maybe Python is a great language for writing a database in, but, you know, I don't want to use the Zope, object, the ZODP, ZODB. I want to use whichever database I want. And the same goes for operating system and web server and everything. In other words, try to take advantage of some of the lower level foundational stuff that's already out there. And I recognize now, particularly in the Apache project, there's some guesswork. Okay, which ones of these are actually going to make it and thrive? Where should we place our bets? But I think that if some of that development energy that went into lower level stuff was moved up to higher level capabilities, you would get closer to the business user and create more features that that business users and editors actually really want. Create more common tools like the Twingle that many of you have seen. I don't know whether this is interop or not. If interop means getting different open source content management systems to work better together, I'm not sure that there's really a lot of really compelling use cases for that. If interop means let's all develop a common XML-based workflow modeling system or a browser that had a browser-based interface into it that generated WFML, and whatever we do with that WFML, we don't know, but yeah.
Of course, you're totally right. The two are closely related. We are building a server-to-server interop between CMS so that we may have a client-to-server interop. Like having settling on a web dev on the back end allows us to write one tool for the front end and do what you say.
Right. So, in other words, have a single tool that can work across both of them is what. Yeah, that's exactly what I would be looking for.
And I'll take the other last word on that, which is I think there's a strong imperative for letting customers throw out their content management system and replace it with another. If we're going to represent openness, one of the classic hallmarks of proprietary software is lock-in. So we should be in favor and supportive of the opposite.
Right.
And things like interop help customers say, instead of 90% different, they're now 80% different or 70% different or whatever, reducing that.
Right.
And your point is still valid.
Yeah, I guess it depends on what you mean exactly by interop. Is it interop is that can the two systems talk to each other, or do they share common services?
Mm-hmm.
I would like to see the sharing of common services. Then the other piece to this is, he who defines what things the labels for things often has a lot of power. And so that's why what I'm most excited about in the whole CMSML effort that Bob Doyle has been and the related stuff around that is for us to come up with a common set of terms that we may or may not get commercial vendors to follow, but that us as a community, we can say, this is what we mean when we say aggregation. This is what we mean when we say personalization. This is what we mean when we say version control as opposed to versioning. Okay, that one I think people get the difference. But, you know, these sorts of things, and then if all the open source, then that makes it, if all the open source projects follow that same lingo, it makes it a lot easier for people to compare, not just compare those products, but also to select which one is going to be right for them. So that's, in brief, was my manifesto. So any more questions?
I have two questions. The first one maybe you don't want to answer, but so you've listed a bunch of features of proprietary or commercial content management systems. In your view, if I'm looking at open source projects, which provides sort of the best mix of features? What would you use? Then the second question is, given that the commercial vendors have a strong interest in lock-in, and given that even an open source developer prefers a guy to use his software than some other open source project, how likely do you think that the degree of openness and avoidance of lock-in that you're promoting here really is? I mean, is that going to happen, or are we wishing for something that won't happen?
Well, to answer your first question, I won't really answer because I never get engaged in horse racing. I can't. That's one of the things I can't stand about the Gartner Group is that they say generically, this one is farthest out in the four quadrants and is therefore the better product. I believe that every product, and including potentially every open source package, has a time and a place for a particular need. There are ways of looking at them, though, and dimensions to examine, which would be the maturity of the product. It's whether its API is going to give you the kind of access to it that you know you're going to need to make. What is the support like? What are the number of developers around that you can tap? I mean, there's a lot of things you can look at to examine an open source one to see whether it fit your needs. We picked Midgard because we knew PHP and because we didn't need any workflow in our system. And Midgard, has extremely weak workflow. But that wasn't really important to us. Whereas for someone else, workflow might be extremely important to them. And in my opinion, Midgard would not be the first place that I would look unless I wanted to do a lot of really complex coding. As far as your second question, I think that the commercial community has already gone to the commercial vendors and say, we don't want to get locked in either. We want you to use these standards. And commercial vendors, some of them more aggressively, some of them kicking and screaming, are beginning to do that. How much that mitigates the lock-in problem, I don't know. But the fact that something is using J2EE standards, however fungible they may be, and the fact that I can put it over any database I want, gives me, and the fact that I can input and output XML from that system, and the fact that I'm doing the template logic in fairly standard JSP, maybe using somebody's non-proprietary tag library, some standard tag library, makes me feel a lot more comfortable about what I'm going to be able to recycle somewhere else if that vendor doesn't come through for me.
Hey, Tony. If I can, I'd like to turn the tables on Mike and ask a question about his product. This is Mike Olson from Sleepy Cat, which is one of the best damn companies around, so everybody should talk to them later. They're in the midst of rolling out Berkeley DB XML, which is a multi-language native XML engine. Do you think the market is ready? Is the mainstream market ready for native XML engines?
I don't know. I'm inclined to say no, despite the fact that there's an obvious case for it. I would like to say yes, but I'm inclined to say no because people feel very, I'll say proprietary in different senses, where people feel very proprietary about their commercial databases. Even in cases where an XML database makes obvious sense, I find almost a kind of emotional resistance in some commercial firms. That's changing some, particularly in government and science and research, where people tend to adapt new tools and see obvious benefits in using a native XML repository. So there is one. Some content management systems like Documentum and Interwoven have essentially their own proprietary object model over a file system-based repository. And that's the obvious case, and they've been the ones most aggressively partnering, because since they don't use relational databases and never did, they're the obvious ones to immediately just throw in. In fact, they now offer the option of using an XML, native XML data store, as opposed to their own somewhat kludgy object layer.
So first I want to say I agree. I'm not convinced that there's demand in the marketplace yet for a native XML database. We built this thing because there's enough XML flowing around on the network that it seems like there may be a pony in the barn somewhere.
Yeah.
Right? And we want to be there early enough to get the open source support. I do want to say, if folks are building CMS repositories, if people are building CMS systems and looking for XML storage, we'd love to talk to you. Particularly open source vendors can use BerkeleyDB for free, and we'd like to see that happen.
I think that's excellent.
I want to make one other point on thinking about databases, though. If you're building a CMS and you're thinking about database management on behalf of your customers, I think you're doing the wrong thing. You shouldn't be out selling Oracle along with your CMS. You should be selling a CMS, and it should store data however it stores it. But if you're arguing with the customer about the database engine on the site, you're only creating excuses not to buy. So you can do two things. You can adopt an open standard, or you can just bury the data management inside the application and not make it a database sale at all. Those are really the two choices.
Yeah, and in fact, that's what some vendors have done by essentially telling you that you don't need a database. That was always one of Interwoven's great sales points, and still is today. You don't need a database. Can't get around the need for a repository, though. And it's got to be structured somehow, and that's the tough part. Any other? Great. Oh, one more.
I was wondering if you could speak toward this idea of breaking up content creation from publication from delivery, and how some of these huge monolithic frameworks that are just all in Java or Python, whatever, how they reinvent the kind of things like groups and accounts and permissions that already exist within, you know, operating systems that have been around for 30, 40 years.
Yeah.
File systems, like the classic object, you know, resource is a file. And I, the guys with like Plan 9 and stuff are taking that further on. I've always had this problem of stuffing everything into a relational database because...
Well, that's a separate issue. I think there are reasons why you may want to put things into databases, and file-based content management systems have issues, have problems. But I agree with your general contention that we should be not reinventing things. The creation piece is a little bit different because, yes, some content is going to be created outside the content management system, but many people are going to want to create content inside the content management system, so you need both sort of interfaces. But I am a firm believer in the separation of management and delivery, both physical separation and logical separation.
You touched on a point that it would be interesting for the different CMS vendors, or open source, that there's 75, I think there's even more, to maybe share some things, some applications or some... Do you have any specific examples where, you know, everybody could share one thing or two things, which would maybe be a start on that process?
Well, the one that I mentioned, which would be a forms-based interface for writing and reading WFML compliant workflow routines, and then being able to ingest and use those would be tremendously useful. The other big one, by the way, was the visual versioning that I showed you. There's a company called DocuComp who says successfully thus far that they have a patent on that. Microsoft actually licenses their technology, and other people, even if you build your own, they're going to come after you. So maybe there's some good lawyers here at the Berkman Center who can help the open source community come up with their alternative for doing that kind of a visual rendered diff as opposed to the kind of RCS code level diff, which is what most people have, but many end users don't find particularly useful. So those are two, you know, right out of the gate. The other thing too would be, to the extent that custom connectors to legacy systems, if PeopleSoft is the ERP of choice among major universities and the open source community wants to win in the university world, then it seems like maybe some work could be done on a common framework for how to get content at least out of PeopleSoft, not necessarily back in, which is a much tougher exercise. You know, those are the sorts of things that I think people are looking for.
You said earlier that there's a time and a place for each particular flavor of CMS. What are the kinds of things that you would look at in a customer environment that would lead you to recommend that they look at open source as opposed to commercial solutions?
I usually don't slice it that way. I look at it in terms of, you know, what's your budget, what are your skill sets, what are you trying to accomplish. And I'm usually the person who's actually telling people that there is an open source alternative in the first place. And it's not unusual, and I believe it's right and proper that you can go into a situation where, you know, Zope is going up against Rhythmix, is going up against Interwoven, and going up against an ASP. And the customer, all of them maybe can meet the customer's needs, but they're going to do it in different ways. And it's up to the customer, you know, or my client, the buyer, to judge that. There are situations where for I would say intellectual reasons, or based on past history, you go into an organization and say, we only want open source because we've had such good fortune with it before. I question that sometimes, but you know, there are those situations where people have already decided they're going to do open source.
On the content lock-in issue, so of course customers don't want lock-in, and of course vendors want to lock you in. So this comes down to a negotiation and, you know, sources of buyer power and supplier power. So in your observation, are things shifting? What are the new sources of buyer power that actually can cause vendors to respond to this kind of pressure? And if the open source community does respond, will people actually choose those alternatives as a direct consequence?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I believe one of the other things that has been a great boon to commercial vendors is they have created communities around their products and create actually very rich and useful conference, user group conferences. And they listen to their, this is the downside, they listen to their biggest customers, okay, the ones who are bringing them the most recurring revenue, and those customers drive the product roadmap, but it also gives an opportunity for people to sound off. And this is kind of some community building they've almost sort of borrowed from the open source community, and that's a lot of what's driving roadmaps in general.
Do we have time for one more?
Sure.
On your previous question about considering open source versus commercial products, earlier you mentioned that ASP or hosted solutions is another alternative. Are companies really choosing hosted solutions, and why?
Yes, they are, and this is one of the great surprises of the past couple of years. I never thought that hosted content management systems would take off, and right now they play a very vital role in the ecosystem, serving a lot of departmental installations. And what they do is get around this whole notion that content management is about technology, and they create a very predictable environment for people to manage their content and then typically deploy it back to their own delivery servers. Okay, because people like to own their own delivery servers, but they're willing to have their content actually managed somewhere else so long as all the typical SLAs and everything are in place. And what the ASP vendors have that other commercial vendors don't have is that when they make upgrades and changes, they don't have to go through a lot of regression analysis about how it's going to work with all these different databases and all these different operating systems, because they have one single environment. So they're able to focus a lot on features and user-oriented features, and that has helped them win a substantial amount of market share. And not everyone wants to have their content managed off-site. But there are use cases where people have found it truly a godsend and has gotten them away from the technology and the implementation and thinking more about the value of their content and how are they going to manage it to get more out of it, which is what we really want people thinking about, right? Well, there's three major ones and several minor ones. The three major ones are Adams, who has the search engine, Crown Peak, whose CTO I believe is here, and they're in Los Angeles. And there's four major ones. Clickability, which is in New York City, and they've been an ASP doing other stuff for a long time and have a really good track record. And the other one is a big Canadian company at more of the lower end of the marketplace, which is called iUpload. It's an awful name, but they've been relatively successful. And there's a bunch of smaller players. Okay. Right. Okay.